You're listening to Spellbound.
It's episode 44 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Thanks for being here today. Well, you know, wherever you are, thanks for being there. Thanks for putting your headphones in. Today's episode is brought to you by RX Bar, the whole food protein bar with simple, real ingredients and no BS. We're going to talk about them a little bit later, but for now, let's get into it. Two Damn White Guys are back in the flesh, in the digital flesh, that is, here with Andrew Rader. The fax machine is in the house again.
I'm back.
Andrew has a cold today. Poor guy. What a trooper. We've got a great episode for you guys today. We're going to be kind of doing a recap of the origins of Phoenician language, the very first phonetic languages. And it's kind of, it's fascinating how all this stuff evolves, because it's like we used to use pictures for work to communicate, and now we just have all these characters that represent vowels and consonants, like the actual movements we're doing with our mouth. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, the first type of writing we use was like maps. That's Lascaux. It's like the animals. You draw the animals on the caves, and it kind of shows you where the animals are and stuff like that. So it's all about communicating information. Started with pictures and then went to symbols.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because people would have, you know, primitive people would have not just been using writing to have conversation. They would be using it to communicate pertinent information, like where the food is and stuff
like
that.
Yeah, no, exactly. All the early writing was purely just to communicate information. It wasn't about telling a story, like a fiction story, for entertainment purposes. It's just for recording information. I guess the pictures are a little bit, like, fun, too, like a painting.
I wonder what primitive people would have thought of, you know, modern writing, because it's so, I mean, I think a lot of people take for granted how specifically we can communicate, you know, what to what level we can do that. I mean, if you look at all those ancient inscriptions on caves and stuff that we have, they're not too sophisticated. It's pretty amazing how much written language, phonetic language, allows us to get really specific with our thoughts.
Yeah, it kind of blows your mind, actually, because we're looking at little symbols on pieces of dead tree that cause our brain to hallucinate. That's what writing is. That's what reading is. I mean, that's weird, right? And it's amazing that an animal who grew up just like hunting, gathering on the plains of Africa can look at like these little symbols and hallucinate and have these thoughts that are contained within the symbols and do it really quickly. Like we can read, you know, whole page in less than a minute. I mean, that's kind of amazing, right?
So what you're saying is reading is a form of a drug.
Yeah, I guess it kind of is. I mean, causes
like
your brain.
Reading is a hallucinogenic.
Yeah, it causes your brain to have hallucinations. Or
I'd never thought of it
images,
that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, today we're just going to do a little recap just to kind of help us appreciate what modern writing is, because, you know, we read all the time, you know, probably, I bet reading is down overall globally because of just the way people consume now. Everybody wants to watch stuff or listen to things. So I bet reading has kind of gone down a little bit as opposed to years past, but it's such an amazing thing that we can do. And I think it just helps us kind of, it was helpful for me kind of learning about how syllabic writing came about and just helps me appreciate, you know, what we have even more.
Yeah. Something that you said to me, which was really interesting, was the Phoenicians gave us the word phonetic, which is really cool. That's one of the ones that I know you want to talk about.
Yeah, so the Phoenicians invented the very first language that was, you know, not a pictographic language, you know, symbolic of other things. Like, you know, I guess in the past they would have, if you wanted to say, like, a cow was eaten by a wolf or something like that. I mean, how would you even describe, how would you even portray that pictographically?
Well, so there's two basic types of languages. They're syllabic and logograms. So even Chinese today is logograms. So a logogram is basically where a symbol represents a word. So Chinese has like, I think it's like 50,000 different symbols, but only about 5 to 10,000 are in regular use. But then the Phoenicians, what they did was they made a symbol make a sound, which is what we have today. Like A is for apple, A makes a sound, right? So they invented kind of the letters that make sounds that are the building blocks of words rather than having a symbol for a word.
I guess that makes sense that pictures were first because everybody could see clearly what you were drawing, and it's like, you know, playing charades or something, or you know, so you're kind of, it's easy, it makes sense that was the first one. And then somewhere along the way, for whatever reason, we invented these characters that that represent the movements we're making with our mouth. You know, we reduced our alphabets from what were like thousands of hieroglyphs into like just 22 characters in the alphabet. And so it's just probably, it makes sense that it's easier for people to communicate that way because it's, you know, it's just, it's a representation of talking, which is probably our most, that's probably our most primitive form of communication with like grunting and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it makes sense to simplify the drawings. Like writing is basically just like simplified drawing. So instead of drawing an antelope, we just like compress it into something that you can do with a pen really quickly. Mm-hmm. By the way, can you hear the baby crying?
I can a little bit. We are recording in our homes today. Andrew's in California. I'm in Nashville. You may hear some washing machines. You may hear some babies. This is real life, people.
Yep.
So yeah, people were drawing things and then they went on to, you know, have these characters that represent the actual sounds that they're making with their voices. And it makes sense that this was a contagious invention because everybody realized how beneficial it was going to be, how much it was going to streamline communication. And that's exactly what we see that it went on to do.
Well, you have two types and both types are still in use today. One is where the symbol is a word. So instead of like spelling out antelope, you have a symbol for antelope. And that's how Chinese works.
And that's pictographic.
Logogram, it's called officially, but you could call it pictographic, I guess. Yeah, it's kind of like that. It's an explanation, yeah.
And then the opposite of that is what we call syllabic writing, which is writing that came from, it just makes up syllables.
Yeah, kind of like Lego.
Yeah.
You have like building blocks that make up bigger words and yeah, for other sounds. So A has no connection to apple, except that it happens to be in the word apple, but there's like nothing associated with A that makes it an apple, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So it's Phoenicia that invents this first syllabic language that can be written down. I get where is Phoenicia? That's like modern day
Syria.
Lebanon? Syria.
Close to Syria, Lebanon, actually. Phoenicia okay. had a lot of cedar timber, which is on the Lebanese flag today.
Right.
And Phoenicia was a thalassocracy, which means a maritime trading empire. So it was a bunch of cultures who were kind of connected, but there was no like one unified king. They were kind of like dispersed trading realm. So they were throughout the Mediterranean. They were the best seafarers. They invented long distance maritime trade. They founded Carthage, which was the big rival of Rome. They sailed down the coast of Africa. They explored further than any Europeans for over 1,000 years. They may have even reached America.
So a fun fact about the Phoenician alphabet that just kind of made me laugh the first time I heard it is, first of all, we call it an alphabet, which is, it's another way of saying alpha beta, which was a way that they would have understood their earliest alphabets. And we don't call it an alpha beta because we call it an alphabet,
wow,
but it's also kind of alpha beta means AB. And those are the first two letters of our modern alphabet. It was also the first two letters of the Phoenician alphabet. And they were symbolized by, the A was represented by a bull because it was the primary asset of those people at that time. So that's why the A, the capital A, looks like it has two horns coming down on the sides because it looks like you're looking at the top of a bull head.
Mm.
And then the B, the B for beta was a house. So that was like, you know, obviously the idea of settled life, living in houses, which was a relatively new idea at the time. So that's where we get the word alphabet.
Wow.
Alpha beta. Bull house.
And the Phoenician alphabet gradually replaced other Middle Eastern writing systems like cuneiform, which is the earlier one, which is just for kind of recording transactions and stuff. And it's just scratches into tablets, basically.
Yeah. So let's talk about cuneiform because it's fascinating because when I was researching this, it looks like, you know, I don't think anybody denies that Egyptian hieroglyphs were first, right? That was like the first kind of official written language, right?
No, I mean, cuneiform and Egyptian hieroglyphics were right around the same time. I think actually cuneiform predates hieroglyphics. The other thing about hieroglyphics is when they studied it, they realized it was actually basically a syllabic language. So, you know, like you have the little bird and the snake and the different symbols in the Egyptian temple writing, the hieroglyphics, it actually makes sounds, not words. So
the pictographic languages made sounds?
Well, some do and some don't, right? Like Chinese is a pictographic language that makes words, but Egyptian hieroglyphics actually made sounds.
Is that just because people were looking at a picture of a bull and saying bull, more or less?
No, I think the hieroglyphics basically were a building block language. So I'm not sure that the Phoenician one actually was first. The Egyptian hieroglyphics kind of did the same thing. Hieroglyphic is a little bit of a vague concept that's used for many different languages that aren't really related. It's actually kind of a misnomer. But the ancient Egyptian writing system had symbols, but the symbols made sounds. Maybe more compound sounds, so it's not just like one letter, but it's several letters put together. I think that might be the case.
Okay, so you're saying that to call hieroglyphics pictographic only is inaccurate.
Yeah, well, they are pictographs, but they're pictographs that make sounds, not words. So they're pictographs syllabic. They're not logogram. Pictogram just means it's picture, so it could make a word or a sound. Logogram is where a picture makes a word.
So what's fascinating is you see this, when you look at it all from a bird's eye view, you can see how humans invented this thing. And it kind of starts out very primitive with pictures, and then it goes on to, you know, depict vowels and consonants. And what's crazy is where Phoenicia was is basically right where the promised land of Abraham was. It's like, you know, so the story of Abraham goes, he supposedly traveled from this place called Ur to Haran, which is now, you know, that was like his promised land area, you know, what becomes Israel. And that's right where these Phoenician societies are. And that's right where the Old Testament emerges. And so it the Phoenician alphabet is emerging right around the same time that the Old Testament emerges, and in the exact place. And it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. It's a little bit north of Israel, but I'm sure there was definitely connections. Yeah.
It's just fascinating because, you know, the Bible has been such a influential book, and it comes out of this area where Phoenician language would have been exploding.
Yeah.
So it's like our first history book that was written down this way or something like that.
Well, the Phoenicians, you know, they traded a lot throughout the Mediterranean. They were the first people to go out overseas and actually found colonies. I mean, the Polynesians did that in the Pacific, but they were the first kind of classical civilization in the Mediterranean to do that. So there's a lot of exchange. I think that's maybe why there's a lot of exchanging ideas as a result of Phoenician seafarers going out and discovering new lands and trading with new people. I mean, the Phoenicians really kind of built our civilization to some extent by going out and making contact with the primitive Romans at the time and really trading with the Greeks and helping Greek civilization along the way. They established bases in Spain, which eventually became, you know, part of Europe. So the Phoenicians were really influential in spreading ideas.
Why do you think that was? Was it just because the Phoenicians were so highly advanced and they had like travel figured out or something? And so their ideas were contagious?
Yeah, it was their form of government. It was very decentralized. It's unclear if they actually were like a unified people or just a bunch of people who had related culture, and they had really great maritime technology. They invented like deep sea ships with big bottoms and high cargo capacities. So their sailing technology was the best in the world for the time. And they were just based on trade and exchanging ideas. So they're really like the same way the Greeks contributed to our civilization. The Greeks went overseas and met new people and exchanged ideas. This is actually what my book is totally about. How exploration created the modern world.
You keep plugging this book. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah.
We're going to take our sponsored break a little early this week because we're about to dive into some heady stuff, and there won't be a good time to break away. So we're going to put a pin right here to talk about the people who made this episode possible, RX Bar. I love these guys. I love their product. I have a bunch of them in my pantry right now, and my friends know that I have them, so they keep coming over to steal them. If you're on the go a lot, I cannot stress how convenient it is to have a bunch of these around because, you know, it's like just carrying a meal around. You've got a meal with you anywhere you go. If you don't know the next time you're going to be able to stop somewhere for lunch, you got an RX bar in your bag, you pull it out, all of a sudden you're eating lunch, baby. I know I get a little amped up about this, but, you know, I'm a practical kind of guy with practical needs. I got kids. I got kids to feed. We're all eating RX bars over here. It's all we're eating. What I love about RX Bar is not only how great they taste, but also how great they are for you. It's all real ingredients, no BS, as you find in so many of these protein bars out there that are labeled as health food, but it's like loaded with sugar and all these additives and preservatives and fillers. None of that stuff in an RX bar. And all the packaging is completely transparent. All the ingredients are labeled on the front. It's the biggest letters on the freaking package, so you know instantly what you're about to eat. These are the bars you've seen on the shelf that have egg whites for protein, dates to hold it all together, nuts for texture, and ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, spices like sea salt and cinnamon, and real fruit. You know, this stuff actually tastes good when you eat it because it's real food. That's the whole point. RX bars are all gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, and whether you prefer sweet, savory, chocolatey, or fruity, there is definitely an RX bar for you. Never ever any artificial colors, artificial flavors, preservatives, or fillers. You may be thinking, what the heck are egg whites doing in a protein bar? But I gotta tell you, these flavors are so well put together, and the egg whites are a great protein source that's easy for your body to absorb. So you want the egg whites. It's kind of what makes it a meal, but you'd never know there's eggs in it. The way they do it is so tasteful, and there's 14 flavor varieties currently. I'm going to read them off here. Mango pineapple, chocolate hazelnut, peanut butter and berries, chocolate sea salt. That last one's one of my personal favorites. Chocolate coconut. That's my next favorite. They're right there together. Mixed berry, blueberry, maple sea salt, apple cinnamon, mint chocolate chip, peanut butter chocolate, and coffee chocolate. I also see seasonal flavors occasionally, so I think they're constantly, you know, experimenting with things, which I like. They've also got this RX nut butter. It's made very similarly to the bars. It's with very few simple ingredients like egg whites, fruits, nuts. Each single serving packet contains 9 grams of high quality protein. It's squeezable, spreadable, and tastes delicious on some fruit, rice cakes, pretzels, or straight out of the pouch if you're feeling like a toddler. The nut butter comes in peanut butter, honey cinnamon peanut butter, and vanilla almond butter. Give me a break. They're giving you guys a special offer for listening. Go to rxbar.com/spellbound for 25% off your first order. Enter the promo code spellbound at checkout. That's rxbar.com/spellbound, promo code spellbound for 25% off. And that is US only. Unfortunately, they can't be shipping RX bars all over the world for 25% off. It's just, you know, they would go under and then we'd have no more RX bars. All right, let's talk about what's going on in writing around the time of Phoenicia when they're inventing this first phonetic language. And the other types of writing that were around, I mean, because, you know, like you said, a lot of Eastern languages are still kind of pictographic. So it hasn't quite all evolved the same way. So it's fascinating this time where complex society is still kind of new and people are kind of inventing new things. And, you know, what kind of languages do we see in other cultures around that time?
Well, also when you say pictographic languages, I think we're also maybe giving the impression that like one is superior. And I don't think that's true. I think it's equally kind of reasonable to have a phonetic alphabet as it is to have a logogram alphabet, which is more likely to be pictographic, as you say. So like Chinese, for example, it's a whole bunch of different characters and it makes
real quick,
it
if I can just interject, I'm not saying that I think anything is. I'm not saying that either of these styles is better than the other.
Right.
But that they evolved out of the places they did for a reason, and they've kind of just stuck, and you know they've continued to, you know, mature and take on new shapes over the years.
Maybe so. Also, there's an interesting question whether our writing affects the way we think a little bit, right? We were talking about this with language. If mm-hmm. the way you talk your language actually affects the way you think. And it's interesting if you have a logogram language, if that somehow impacts the way you think more like compartmentalized or something like that.
I think it does, because ever since I've started writing, the way I think and even the way I talk is different, because whenever I feel like whenever I open my mouth to talk now, I feel like I'm typing on a keyboard. Yeah. So it's got to affect the way you think.
Yeah, and there's different ways to interact with keyboards, actually, in Chinese. One is pinyin, where you kind of spell out the sounds. So you would use like a English keyboard or a QWERTY keyboard and type out sounds that would make Chinese characters. Or there's one where you actually assemble different sub-pictures to make bigger pictures. That's called Wubi. And a good Chinese typer can type just as fast as a Western typer just using these systems. Because it's kind of more efficient in a way because you get to type one word at a time, right? Instead of just like mm-hmm. one letter. Like a word can have like 20 letters in it. But if you're just building up a a character out of four sub-symbols is basically like getting a whole word for four.
Is it not fair to say that syllabic writing is more efficient in some way? And that's not to say that it's better, but that maybe it's quicker or something, because, you know, the one stat that stood out to me when I was researching this is about how many characters there were in pictographic languages. You know, you need a picture for everything you're trying to communicate, whereas with syllabic writing, you're just, you know, you're typing sounds.
Yes, sort of. But even with our language, we need to remember the words for everything. So it's not like that much harder to just remember the pictures for things than remember the words for things. You have to learn the words for everything. So I don't really see how...
That's true.
It's not really more efficient necessarily. One thing is...
Maybe it's harder to memorize to write it out.
So like if you hear a word, you can guess how it's spelt just by how it sounds. Whereas like mm-hmm. in Chinese... No hope for that, right? Not possible. You have to see how it's written in order to write it. The other thing is, because it's modular, it's little building blocks, our alphabet, it makes it easier to print things. So the printing press took off in Europe, but not really in China. Even though it was invented in China, once it came to Europe, it was explosive. And it was like the internet. And in the 1400s, started with three printing presses. That's the Gutenberg Bible. Was one of the first mm-hmm. in Mainz. But by the end of the century, that was about 1450-ish. But by the end of the century, there were thousands of printing press and millions of books. And this really kicked off the scientific revolution. And it was when Columbus was growing up. And it's when all the science started in Europe. And it was just because of the spread of books. And the books were easier to print because you could reuse the letters. So it's movable type, right? So you just had all these letters. And it's like making a sign out of those, you know, in front of churches and stuff like that in restaurants and hotels.
Yeah, the ones everybody messes up.
Yeah, exactly. You just rearrange the letters, right? Well, how you print a book is you just rearrange the letters. They're like stamps, right? You rearrange the stamps of the letters on a page and you just print out the book. Whereas Chinese, you have to have a different symbol for each word. So you have to have like 5,000 different symbols. Whereas for
that's
Latin,
a much more expensive
alphabet,
printing
it's
press.
26. Yeah, and it's more expensive and it's harder to use. Yeah, exactly. So
can you imagine a typewriter with all those hieroglyphs on it?
Right, that's what I'm saying. So like Chinese keyboards, the Wubi ones, which do use symbols, don't have like full symbols because you'd need 5,000 keys. So they have subsets of symbols that you build.
It's like
up.
Flying an airplane.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can't really, it's not modular, so you have to have the whole thing, but they get around that by kind of building up the characters.
So maybe what is fair to say is that syllabic writing has a lower barrier to entry, but that both, you know, syllabic writing and pictographic writing are just equally as efficient to the person who knows how to use them.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if that's true, because if you're trying to teach a kid how to write, you have to teach them all the letters and you have to teach them how they sound and how they go together. And you have to get across the concepts of verbs and vowels and consonants. Whereas Chinese, you want to teach them to write their name or a word or something. You just teach them one symbol. That's way easier. So the barrier to entry is probably lower, actually.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, what do I know? I'm just one damn white guy.
The other thing is there are a lot of hybrid languages which use logograms, so like pictures to mean words, but then they tag on modifiers. This is how Japanese works. So Japanese uses kanji symbols, which are based on the Chinese characters, but then they add modifiers to them to change the tense or change ownership or different kinds of things. So Japanese writing, if you look at it, has... It, like Chinese characters and then modifiers at the end, right? Huh. And this is exactly how the Mayan language worked in the Americas too. People used to think that the Mayan language was just like Chinese, logogram. So it had a symbol for a word. But then when they started doing some more analysis, it turned out that actually a lot of the Mayan symbols just made sounds, not words. So there's a lot of hybrid. So it's not just one or the other.
Everybody, this is what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago with, you know, the ping-ponging of human progress. Everybody's inspired by each other and ideas are contagious and everybody kind of takes what's available to them and, you know, creates this mishmash of their own culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is like the runes, you know, the Viking runes and Celtic runes and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
These were copies of early Italian writing. So the Etruscans were a civilization in northern Italy. And this had kind of spread through Europe, their writing system, and the Germanic tribes and the Scandinavians and the people in Britain and stuff had sort of realized that this exists and invented their own writing based on this, and that's what we call runes.
And runes are pictographic? Logographic?
No, actually, I believe that they're syllabic, so they make sounds.
Okay.
They may be a hybrid. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think that they make sounds.
One thing that's really incredible to me about, you know, going back to Phoenician society, the first phonetic language, and, you know, this language that's just exploding in what is now Syria, Lebanon, is, you know, we kind of talked about this earlier, the fact that the Bible comes out of this area, and this book was, you know, apparently from its emergence, it was just this hugely influential book. And I don't think it was just because of syllabic writing. Obviously, there was a bunch of cultural stuff going on, and Israel was kind of like an underdog that rose to power and then, you know, faced a bunch of difficulty numerous times, and they just, you know, kept surviving. They were like a force to be reckoned with. So that I'm not saying it's all just because of phonetic language that the Bible was influential, but it's amazing when you look at the creation account in Genesis, the lengths the author goes to ascribe names to things that people would have already known about, you know, like, you know, God names the vast sky in the creation account. He gives name to people. He gives people permission to name all the animals. And there's all this, you know, in the creation account, there's all this constant naming of things. And it's crazy to think that this, you know, to the first readers of these texts, these would have been not only stories to kind of, you know, give them a philosophy to live by, but also giving like written words to, you know, the very first written syllabic words to represent things they'd always seen, like the sky and animals and things like that.
Yeah, maybe. Are you suggesting that maybe it's like they were trying to unify people by saying, okay, everyone call this a cow? Before, you used to call it all kinds of different things, but now it's called a cow, or whatever the Hebrew word for cow is, which is probably similar to ours because I think they're both Indo-European.
I'm not a Bible scholar. I have friends with some of the best Bible scholars. I've talked to them about these ideas. They say that there's no way to prove that, you know, that is what the Old Testament creation account is. Obviously, you can't do that without reading between the lines of, you know, what is written and what was happening culturally at the time and kind of, you know, making some leaps. But it is kind of fascinating to think that these would have been the first writings kind of orienting people with written syllabic language. And so, you know, the creation account, you know, when you read it that way, knowing where it was written and by whom it was written and in what time it was written, it's fascinating to think of it that way.
Yep. Yeah. A lot going on. I think if anything, it's more just the Phoenician exchange of ideas than it is the writing itself. But The Phoenicians were hugely influential. It's kind of strange that people don't know as much about them.
Hooked on Phoenicia.
Yeah, exactly. Hooked on Phoenicia.
So I wonder if, you know, going back to what you were saying about how our written languages might affect the way that we think, I wonder if there's something to say about different, you know, maybe our written languages make it harder for us to understand each other, too. Like maybe our ways of life kind of come out of, maybe everything comes out of the way we write.
A little bit, but I think it's pretty subtle, actually. It might have some slight influence in the way you think, but I don't think it's going to be huge because, you know, we're all human. We all have the same emotions. We all have the same, you know, basic genetics and stuff. So I think the effect has to be pretty minimal and kind of like a cultural effect rather than something that's fundamental.
But yeah, that's what I mean culturally. Not fundamentally, but culturally.
I agree. There probably is something, but it's not a huge effect, probably.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, like it's kind of like what you were saying a second ago about how the printing press was invented in China, but it didn't really erupt until it got to the cultures that were using phonetic language.
Yeah, it's sort of unclear whether it's because of the alphabet difference that the printing press really took off in Europe, or if it was because of the competition. Because like we discussed in the Chinese episode, China was kind of this unified empire where Europe had at one point in the 1400s, 3,000 different polities. So like duchies and kingdoms and states and empires.
Polities? Did you say policies or polities?
Polities. So meaning like distinct political units. So like each city was like a different political unit, right? So because Europe was so divided, it had so many different little subsets that were competing with each other. It was an arms race. And the printing press really exploded because people were trying to spread their ideas. Like this was right around the Reformation where Martin Luther, I forget how many theses, the 36 or whatever it was, theses to Wittenberg, the cathedral. He nailed his theses. Start of Protestantism against the Catholic Church. So they were all trying to spread pamphlets, and the Catholics would write pamphlets trying to like support their position and stuff. So it was all because of this competition in Europe that caused the printing press to explode. It's unclear if the alphabet really had much effect, or maybe it did, because it was a little bit easier. But in China, you could have printed books by the page. So you just make a whole page and then imprint that. It's harder to do that. It is more work, but it's not impossible. So it's hard to say how much of it was as a result of the alphabet difference and how much was a result of just the competition in Europe versus this unified empire. But I think that's why Europe really took off and expanded in technology more than the rest of the world at the time, because of the divisions in Europe and the competition. All of Europe was basically an arms race.
When you say competition, you're talking about not religious competition necessarily, right? You're talking about like cultural, like, you know, which society is the biggest and baddest, that kind of stuff.
Religious is a component of it. There was definitely competition in that way, the main one being the Catholic Protestant split, but there's other types of Protestantism and stuff. So religion was a big part of it, but there were a lot of other impacts, just technology in general. Even just cultural, like art and stuff like that, like having in Holland all the paintings and the new style of the paintings, almost everything was revolutionized. Writing and art was huge, but the biggest fear was probably military. So having the best weapons and the best guns and the best tactics to use them. So that was absolutely huge in the 1600s.
It was some things never change, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like... During World War II, for example, technology massively advanced because everyone was competing to have the best technology, right? So you have the development of jet engines, and you have the development of rockets and computers and radar. You know, technology exploded within about 5 years because of the competition of World War II.
Wow.
We should say, actually, it's the 100th anniversary today of the end of World War I.
Oh, yeah. November 11th.
Yep. 11th hour of the 11th day. 100 years ago today.
We're releasing this on the 12th, though, so we don't want to confuse people. Now, the Phoenician alphabet did not have any vowels at first, right? This is the similarity.
Is that true? I don't know. Yeah, some alphabets don't. I wasn't aware of that specifically, but you were just supposed to put a bunch of consonants and kind of figure it out for yourself. There are some alphabets like that, yeah.
Yeah, so let's see here. I'm looking at it now. The Phoenician alphabet is an abjad consisting of 22 letters, all consonants, no vowels.
Yeah. Like if you string a bunch of consonants together, in some ways, it's just the way it naturally comes out. You shouldn't necessarily need vowels, but it does become a little bit like hard to do, I guess.
I guess this is one of the major similarities between the Phoenician alphabet and the, you know, Hebrew or Proto-Canaanite, which came before Hebrew. Which, you know, Proto-Canaanite, from what I understand, was a little bit more influenced by cuneiform, but Hebrew, you know, they're both read from right to left instead of left to right, and they don't have any vowels. So, you know, the Phoenician alphabet, the Proto-Canaanite, and the Hebrew alphabet, they're all pretty similar.
Does Hebrew today still not have vowels?
There are some vowels in Hebrew now, but there were no vowels originally, which is what makes those old writings so hard to read. Unless you're trained in reading ancient Hebrew, you can't really read it. You know, like their word for, you know, and they still don't, the Hebrew still doesn't ever spell out God or Yahweh. entirely. Yeah. They leave out the vowels out of reverence for, you know, for Yahweh. And I think it's, I don't know if that's connected to the fact that ancient Hebrew didn't have vowels, but it is interesting.
Yeah. The other thing is, we're talking about languages and how they're written, but it's not necessary to write a language in a particular way. You can actually change the writing system to keep the language. For example, Turkish was a language that was spoken by the Turkic herdsmen from Central Asia. But they moved to, at least some of them moved to Anatolia, Turkey today, basically, and had the Ottoman Empire. And they didn't have writing originally. They just had a language. But they were really near the Middle East, so they took Arabic as their writing system. So Turkish was written in Arabic using Arabic script. And it was a distinct language from Arabic. So, like, you could speak Arabic and not understand Turkish. Actually, it's exactly like we use the Latin alphabet, but so does German or so does French. So you could kind of be able to read the characters but not know the language, right? Same idea with Turkish.
So you could read it, but you wouldn't know necessarily how that translated into, you know, what mouth
movement. Right, right. In the same way that you could read German but not know what it means. You could, like, sound it out just by knowing what the letters mean. I mean, they may be pronounced differently.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
Yeah.
So you could pronounce it, but you wouldn't know what you're saying.
Right, right. And maybe your pronunciation would be kind of bad, too, because you wouldn't know how it's supposed to sound in that language. But exactly. So it's exactly like that. So Turkish was written in Arabic just because it originally had no alphabet. But in the 1920s, when Mustafa Kemal Atatürk was trying to reform the country and modernize the country, he invented an alphabet. So this might be one of the most recent alphabets ever invented, because he basically invented this alphabet around 1925. So really, less than 100 years ago, he invented this alphabet that all Turkish writing switched from Arabic to the Turkish alphabet today, which is pretty similar to our alphabet. It's basically a variant of Latin. We use the Latin alphabet, by the way. English is written in the Latin alphabet, which is the alphabet that the Romans used.
Right, which is a derivative of Phoenician phonetic language.
It's influenced by Phoenician, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So today, you know, if you live in America, if you speak English, you are speaking a language that is, as we covered in the language episode a few weeks ago, it's not just Greek, it's not just Latin. It's also Indian, Indo-European, mm-hmm. and it's
Germanic.
You know, there's Germanic. Yeah. There's all these different influences, which makes it the most, as you said, the most easily accessible language in the world, because everybody understands at least some of it. And but how has it changed? Has English changed much in, like, recent history, like in the last couple hundred years? It doesn't seem like it's changed that much.
Yeah, I think so. You can tell that even from the split between American and British English, right? I mean, I don't know how ambiguous that is, but, you know, it's something.
But you can still, like, I mean, you can still watch, you can still read old, you know, English writings and make sense of it, even though it's kind of hard. I mean, it hasn't changed, like, structurally too much.
Depends how far back you go. Like, Shakespeare is readable, but sometimes a little bit confusing. But if you go, like, Canterbury Tales from about 300 years earlier, that's kind of hard to read. And then you go earlier than that, and it's really like, what the F is this?
So how new in years is, like how long have we been speaking the way we've been speaking now, for like 100 years or
150 years?
Well,
it's a gradual change, so you can't really say, there's no cutoff point, right? It's just a gradual evolution of language. But,
yeah,
I mean, you could understand the Declaration of Independence that was written like 250 years ago, right? So, yeah, it hasn't changed that much in the last few hundred years. I mean, the divergence really is similar to the difference between British and Australian and New Zealand and American. You know, because that's the kind of separation.
I guess that makes sense. You can kind of actually see that on a macro scale with the way language changes just in 5 years. Like, there's all kinds of different words that are, that the meanings have changed in the last 5 years, or people use them differently because of slang, or because of, people will, you know, simplify things in order to streamline communication. So I guess language is kind of this fluid thing that's always changing a little bit. And then only after years and years and years of hindsight do we really appreciate how far we've come.
Oh, yeah, and I think that's a really good point, that language is changing now much faster than it ever has before. I think the amount of change in the past, like, 10 years is as much as it changed in the past 100 years, just because all that new internet language coming into things. Like, the dictionaries recently added words like fangirl and fanboy to their dictionary, so that's an official word now.
Yeah, personally, I'm really excited about Newspeak.
What's this?
1984.
Oh, is that in the book 1984?
Yeah, Newspeak. It's basically like the language in this dystopian society of the future in 1984. It's like all these words get distilled down into, like, the language doesn't have opposites anymore because the opposite is implied in the word itself. And things like that. It's like really weird and dystopian.
Neat.
That's what we have to look forward to.
All right. It's coming back in 1984.
Yeah. So that's where we are in modern times with language. And, you know, we didn't really talk too much about Eastern languages, I guess, because we were really focusing on Phoenicia and syllabic writings. And so that naturally we turned into a conversation about a lot of Western languages. But I think we established that they're all equally efficient and, you know, they've evolved the way that they've made sense to evolve because of the people that were using them, and that's what language is. It's a malleable, flexible thing that we all get to decide what to do with. Pretty cool.
It's hallucinating.
It's hallucinating. Language is drugs.
Well, writing is hallucinating. Yeah, based on symbols. You're looking at symbols and having thoughts appear in your brain.
Don't read too much. You might get addicted.
Yeah.
This has been a recap of the origins of phonetic language. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Julian Smith. I was joined by Andrew Rader today. If you want to tweet us, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here on Twitter and pretty much everywhere else, although I'm pretty slow on social media. You can tweet Andrew if you want. At Mars Rader is his name on Twitter. That's where he's most active. If you want to support us, you can do that by subscribing. It's a great way for episodes to just magically appear on your device. You don't have to do anything when we upload them. They just show up. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That is super helpful. But we're just glad you're here. We're glad you're listening. So if you feel like being unhelpful, just keep listening. Have a great week. We'll see you guys next Monday.